The 2020 World Tour season is chugging along, and we here at VelaNews.com have you covered with all of the news and race reports, photo galleries, stuff like that coming from the Vuelta a España. And as you heard me talk about a few weeks ago, for fans who want a deeper relationship with their sport, we have our new Active Pass and VelaNews Pass digital membership, which brings you exclusive behind-the-scenes analysis, reporting, perspective on the racing. And that is part of our new digital membership that we launched earlier this year. There is the Active Pass membership, $99 a year, where you get access to all of the exclusive digital membership, as well as access to the Roll Massif Elephant Rock Grand Fondo, coaching from Today's Plan, a bunch of cool industry deals from brands like Scratch Labs and Jordana and other brands, and a whole bunch of cool perks. And now we have the VeloNews Pass as well. That is a discounted rate that gets you industry deals as well as access to all the cool stuff on VeloNews.com. We've had great stuff come out of the Giro and the Vuelta. Some of these U.S. rider roundtables where American riders have been sharing their perspective with us on a variety of topics. And some great analysis and behind-the-scenes reporting from Andrew Hood and James Start on just what the heck happened at the Giro d'Italia and the Vuelta a España. So again, it's Active Pass and VeloNews Pass, and you can learn more at VeloNews.com. Okay, let's get on with this week's podcast. Welcome back to the VeloNews Podcast. Fred Dreyer coming to you another busy Tuesday here at the VeloNews home offices. Apologies in advance for crying babies, barking doggies, and just, you know, the level of professionalism that we have come to expect here at the VeloNews podcast. I say this, it's a busy Tuesday. I think our busy Tuesdays are, we're counting them down now, because here we are, second week of the Vuelta a España. The Giro d'Italia is over. The big one-day races pretty much are all over. Home stretch, folks, the end of the 2020 season is in sight, which is a bittersweet thing, I feel like, for all of us. It's been very difficult to cover all aspects of pro racing as a cycling journalist, but we love pro racing. And so the fact that it's counting down, you got to savor it, folks. Watch every stage of the Vuelta a España. Savor the racing moments. Cheer for your, you know, favorite riders like Mike Woods, who won today's stage. And just drink in the sweet nectar of bike racing, because it's coming to a close. On today's podcast, we are going to break down all the exciting elements from the Giro d'Italia, and we're going to talk about what's going on at the Vuelta a España and just what it means in general with James Start and Andrew Hood, both of whom are coming to us today from their respective homelands that are imposing new COVID restrictions. So guys, before we get back to it, it seems like the dynamics from March and April, when you guys were both in lockdown, may be returning. James, we'll start you. What's going on in Paris right now?
Yeah, I got to say, it's pretty depressing. I just came back from a great time at the Giro, and all of a sudden to come back to Paris and the cold and the rain and be looking at lockdown is tough. I mean, at least this spring, the weather was breaking. The weather was gorgeous. You could, you know, have some sun coming in your window or sit on a balcony. You go out for an hour and do your shopping. It wasn't that hard, but you know, it's getting dark early. It's been cold and wet, and this is going to be really hard for a lot of people, including myself, I got to say. So we'll just see. I think the President Macron is going to be giving some new decrees on Thursday, and looking at like total curfew on the weekends, maybe lockdown starting at 7 at night. That's what they're floating out there, and I just not looking forward to this.
Andy, it sounds like similar stuff could be headed your way in Spain. Now, I have serious questions about what curfew looks like in Spain, because y'all don't even go to dinner until like 1 a.m. over there. So, you know, how do Spanish people deal with early curfews?
Yeah, that's right. It's going to be a crisis for everything's late in Spain, you know, late dinners, late drinks, people wake up late. There's even some talk that this might kind of reset the Spanish work week and reset some of the customs to kind of bring them perhaps more in line with traditional European hours. Because it's been an ongoing kind of debate really within Spanish society of having this split work day most folks work from like 10 to 2 and then 4 to 8, you know, very impractical in a modern economy. So there's some discussion of having to squeeze all that down and become almost like Germans, which no one in Spain is too excited about. But yeah, now we're facing lockdown 10 o'clock. So yeah, people have to have dinner at 8. I think the rule is they stop serving meals at 9 to get people out of there by 10 o'clock. So, you know, I remember, you know, Mama Hood, we had dinner at 5:30 in America when I was growing up. But here in Spain, most people don't have dinner till 10. So it's going to be a bit of a culture shock.
Yeah. If you try to install German style rules in Spain, do the Germans give you 3 hours to get loaded on vermouth during the middle of the day on a work week? Is that part of German customs? I don't think so.
No. The Germans, you know, they're 9 to 5. That's what they want to bring the Spanish calendar in sync with the rest of Europe, perhaps. We'd love to see the 35-hour work week in France. I mean, bring that on.
I'd like to see that. I haven't seen that, but it doesn't.
And we could use that at the Villeneuve's offices. Well, guys, we have a ton of racing to get to. Let's start with Giro d'Italia, which wrapped up on Sunday. Thrilling finish. A lot of storylines coming out of it. Teo Gegenhardt and Team Ineos Grenadiers wins the overall after just a dramatic final 5 days of racing. That's Teo and Rowan Dennis really take charge of the race on the stage up and over the Stelvio. And then 2 days later, just detonate poor Sunweb and Wilco Kelderman on the triple ascent of Sestriere. Teo sounds like he really did not come into this race thinking he was a GC contender or even a second level GC contender, and he won. You know, when you guys think back in your memories of Grand Tour racing, when was the last time we had a guy who was seemingly so far down the pecking order as a GC favorite win a Grand Tour? Are there any Grand Tours that come to mind?
I think you'd have to, Andy, I think maybe you'd have to look to the Tour of Spain or something, in the Tour de France. You know, we came close in 2011 with Thomas Vogler, but, you know, in the end, he faded. You know, I mean, even like, was it 2008 Carlos Sastre? I mean, okay, maybe people didn't pick him to win, but he'd been a consistent top 10, top 5 finisher in Grand Tours. You can't say you were shocked by it. Tao's victory was just amazing. You know, it was wonderful. I've known him since the under 23 years, and he's tremendous, tremendous talent and a really nice guy. I was starting to worry that he was going to, you know, just get locked into the, you know, just to the machine lockstep, you know, mentality that Sky and Ineos have often had. But obviously, that changed right here. And what I thought really interesting was that David Brailsford in Milan yesterday was sort of speaking like this was a revelation. Tao sort of was the way he grew into the role. Also, it seemed like at least, you know, on the steps of the Duomo in Milan, that Brailsford all of a sudden came to a new awakening. There's a different kind of racing than just a calculated defensive racing that they've been doing. And he said, you know, we've had a lot of success racing defensively, but really it's a lot more fun to do what we did here. And as Teo came into this, he started thinking about winning, but not just winning, but winning with style and flair, which he obviously did. It was just tremendous. I'm going to be really excited to see how he evolves. It's going to be a game changer for his career for sure.
Yeah, the one that popped to mind for me was Ryder Hesdal when he won the 2012 Giro. Kind of similar situation where he, you know, really wasn't a 5-star favorite, just kept hanging around. And a few of the favorites kind of got dropped out of their race, similar to what we saw this past couple weeks here at the Giro. And then in similar fashion, you know, kind of won it on the last time trial in Milan. But yeah, typically in the Tour, as James was saying, you know, it's so controlled, it's pretty hard to see a surprise winner there. We have seen a few years where a rider might get so much time in a breakaway to hang around in leader jersey for quite a long time. I remember that there was that one Giro where the Spanish rider, his name escapes me, Lopez maybe, Basso finally got rid of him like in the last couple of mountain stages after that rider. Because that was the year that when Richie Porte got into that famous breakaway across the middle of Italy, 2010. One of the Spanish guys got the pink jersey, and he almost won that Giro out of a breakaway, you know, midway through the race. So, what those guys did over the weekend, you know, it was pretty impressive. I mean, I didn't really see these young guys coming in and really be able to dominate the race this Giro in the way that they did. I was expecting more the Nibalis and the Geraint Thomases to really dominate this race. And it just shows that the young riders are coming up and they are just pushing these old guys out of the way.
Yeah, and it really signals a new turnover at Ineos Grenadiers. I mean, you touched on it, James, there about the new style of racing, where for years we've seen that team style of racing is to grab an early lead and then use its armada to just defend and squash everyone. And this one, it's like the team's GC hopes get totally thrown out the window when Geraint Thomas crashes on stage 3. And then the team pivots into this exciting stage hunting mode and they win 7 stages. And look, chapeau to them for, you know, having a successful pivot. But really, what emerges is like this team is so strong with so many hitters that they had the firepower to go on the offensive for a real GC push. And I mean, I guess now is the time to talk about it. I mean, Rowan Dennis earned every single one of his euros that he's getting paid this year on those 2 climbing stages. You know, Rowan Dennis is a guy we've written about over the years here at VeloNews.com and his long-term quest to morph from a TT specialist into a guy capable of winning Grand Tours. And it never really happened. But, you know, Neil Henderson, his coach, talked to us about these monster training days in the mountains and these year-long process to become this awesome climber. And in some of these races where he was given GC leadership, it just didn't really happen from the mountains. But boy, did it happen for him in the mountains in this race, because he's the guy on the Stelvio and then on Sestriere who is able to like up the tempo to such a high level that only Jai Hindley and Theo Gegenhardt could follow him. Like Kelderman, who's a very good climber, it was just like too hot. It was like the water was too hot for Kelderman to follow. And only Rowan Dennis was a guy who was able to lift it to that level for that long a time and then kind of back off. Because in looking back at those stages, you could see where like the climbing tempo that Dennis was setting for Theo and for Jai was real high for like a 10-minute period of time. And that's all you needed to like get rid of Kelderman. And then both groups kind of went back to climbing at about the same tempo. But in that period, like the damage was done. And Kelderman, who on paper, we talked about it last week, he was the guy who had the bona fides and the experience you'd think would win this race. It was too much for him. So, you know, Sky has this the squad that's like going for stage wins and in doing so is racing aggressively and just, you know, ends up winning this race. And I do think it is interesting and important to think about the future of Sky going forward. I mean, is this a strategy that they could employ at the Grand Tours? Is this something that could work for Egan Bernal? Do you have to be kind of an unknown or an untested quantity like Theo Gegenhardt to win a race this way? I don't know. What do you guys think about this Sky Ineos Grenadiers attack style?
I've been thinking about that myself. And because I really thought the words of Dave yesterday, Brailsford, were, really, really, what can you say? They were pretty explosive, really. I mean, after all these years and all this success being this sort of robotic team, he's like all of a sudden seemed to wake up and go, we can be so much more. And it would be wonderful if that's the case, but, I don't know that, you know, time will tell. Part of that also might be that, you know, they got totally dominated by a team that rode very similar to them, but much better than them at the Tour this year, being Jumbo Visma. And all of a sudden, Jumbo Visma was the team that was just riding people off their wheels, including Ineos. So all of a sudden, you know, they didn't have that card to play. If all of a sudden they come around next year and they seem to have that card again, maybe they'll forget about being imaginative, but they might not. And guys like Bernal also might have to go more on the attack, and that would be really exciting. Carapaz has already shown that he loves to attack. And so maybe this is just like the last thing that Brailsford needed to say, you know, there's a different way of doing it, and maybe there's a different way forward for us. It'd be really exciting if that's the case. I think it'll depend on how their own riders evolve and how the team evolves. And if all of a sudden they come into a Grand Tour and are clearly the hands down favorite, or you know, the strongest team, and just ride, you know, guys like Kwiatkowski are riding, you know, team leaders of other teams off their wheel, then they might go back into the defensive style again. But if that doesn't happen, they just might not have a choice. And, you know, hats off, it'll be a much better bike race.
Yeah, I think that that style of racing we saw at the Giro from Ineos was also just a product of that race. I think they might have been racing very differently had your man there, Geraint Thomas, stayed in the race, you know, had the lead in that second time trial. It might have just been the same SkyTrain we've always seen over the years. Yeah. And I think that was their plan from the beginning of the race anyway. And Tao just found the legs and really rode into a vacuum at the top of this race. There really wasn't anyone there dominating and putting their stamp on the race. I mean, Almeida, you know, held pink for more than 2 weeks in his very first Grand Tour. Nothing against him. It kind of just showed you the level of the race. It was very hard, very high. The level was very high and hard, but, you know, it wasn't as deep as at the Tour de France. I think next year, the Tour Sky will come in with a very strong team. And just look who they signed going into next season. You know, Adam Yates and Richie Porte and a few others. And you get Ghana and Rowan Dennis there on the flats, and get a few other guys filling in some spots. And you know, I think the SkyTrain will live on just in a different form. And as James said, you know, you got Jumbo-Visma just steam plowing everybody through this, bulldozing through the peloton. And I think they'll just do that. They'll just hit the replay button on that going into next year.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting also just to see how these teams deal with all this young up and coming talent. I mean, this year's Vuelta or Giro was almost like the Tour de l'Avenir, which was canceled. But, you know, Almeida, Lindley and Gegenhardt, you know, these are all guys that are barely out of the under 23 ranks, right? And all of a sudden, amazing success. And then, you know, on top of that in the Tour, you know, we got Pogacar. And how are the teams going to deal with this? I mean, are these guys ready to all of a sudden become 5-time Tour contenders, you know, big favorites going into all the Grand Tours? I don't know. We saw that Bernal had a hard time translating his success last year. I've already heard and talked to people who are saying, you know, best thing for UAE might be to not even race Pogacar on the Tour next year, to give him a little time to digest this and maybe go for a different Grand Tour with a little less pressure. It's going to be really interesting to see how these teams, and these are all big teams with a lot of experience, how they digest and how they direct and handle all this young talent that have all of a sudden found themselves with so much success so early on.
Yeah, and I think a couple of questions come to mind too, which is like, when guys like this are having this much success this early, what does it mean for their longevity just from a physical performance and motivation standpoint? Like 10 years from now, are we going to see these guys still winning? Or is it like, you know, their best years from a physicality and a motivation and a, you know, inspiration period is right now. And 10 years from now, they're going to be burned out. I mean, that's just a story to keep an eye on. Andy, what do you make though of now Tao Gegenhardt versus Egan Bernal in the pecking order at Ineos? I mean, let's say they are going into the Tour next year. I mean, does this win elevate Tao into the driver's seat for Team Ineos, or is this still the team of Egan Bernal, Tour de France contender?
Yeah, I mean, he was on the long list for this year's Tour, and they sent him off, shipped him off to the Giro instead. I still think a Tour win's bigger than a Giro win, and especially the way Bernal has managed until this year, his career. Obviously, I think he's a step ahead or several steps ahead of Tao, but it's going to be very tough selection for that Ineos Tour team. They got eight spots. They probably have enough guys to fill two teams, really. So they'll have to make some choices, you know, spread the wealth, you know, have some long conversations with people so that they feel like they're being properly used and have the right targets to keep them motivated. Because Tao certainly probably now believes he deserves a shot at the Tour. You know, does that mean he goes as a protected leader? I mean, half that team will be GC caliber riders. You know, who they've done a pretty good job over the past few years managing those different interests and playing all those cards. And then, you know, the year, of course, we saw Garrett Thomas win. You could see a scenario with that, with Teo riding the fumes and then coming through for the win. But it's going to be very crowded at the top at Team Ineos, Grenadiers. They're going to need a bigger SUV to fit all those guys into.
I got to say that if I was Teo right now, I wouldn't be in a rush to be doing the Tour de France. I mean, he has all the freedom he had in the Giro. Let him do that for another year or two. Why not, you know? Or, you know, I wouldn't be in a rush. I think he can still grow and learn, and he can define his own role as a rider better in a race like the Giro or the Vuelta. Personally, that would be my thing, because and also because, you know, there's so much talent at the top of Ineos next year, and so many established riders are going to be wanting to the Tour. But, you know, in a couple of years, I mean, 2 years, Dale could be easily as good as, you know, Yates or Richie, for that matter, at this point, you know, as he's coming into his own. So we'll see, but I wouldn't be at a rush mentally or physically to be doing the Tour if I was him.
It seems like that may not be in line with his personality. I mean, if we're to trust and believe these post-race press conferences, I mean, throughout the Giro, Teo is this just really humble kid who talked about being in awe of the stars and talked about being a kid a lot and how, you know, he wasn't going to let this win change him or change his trajectory. So I think that it will be interesting to see how he evolves from a guy who won the Giro when he was thinking he was going to be a domestique, you know, and rising to the challenge, to being a guy that has a lot of pressure on your back and, you know, sort of the big contender team leader for a Grand Tour. Cause that's two very different things. And, you know, even when he was on Hagens Berman Action, a lot of times he was like one of three team leaders coming into these races. I remember interviewing him at the Tour of Utah a few years back, and it was like Adrian Costa, Theo Gegenhardt, and Nielsen Paulus all going for the overall. You know, Tour California, same sort of thing. It was like, hey, you have this opportunity to present or to really shine, but it was never like this team is built around Theo Gegenhardt and his push for the overall. So how he adjusts to that level of pressure and honestly, the fact that he's going to be a big-time celebrity after this now, just the second Brit ever to win the Giro, and he has this great story that is highly promotable and marketable by Ineos Grenadiers because he's the hometown boy. He's not from Ecuador or from Colombia. He's the British guy who was part of the system, who came along, who, you know, he's been on the radar for a long time. And finally, like our process has paid off. He's the big star. So I really think it's going to be interesting to see how he adjusts to all of that. You know, I mean, before the Giro, he was going to be like talking to guys like us on the side of the, in the start line paddock, and now he's going to be mobbed by all the TV stars and, you know, Eurosport Sky and stuff.
At the Giro, he was one of those guys. I mean, I was at this prologue, and I was checking out the Clive and Montreal on the TT, trying to get recon that and kind of sense. And the Ineos guys came by, you know, and who like yells out, "Hey!" and turns around with a big smile on his face. It's, you know, it's Tao. I mean, he's just, that's the way he is. And as far as I know, I think he'll stay that way in a lot of ways. He's not an arrogant kid, and he loves bike racing, and he really appreciates everybody who's involved in this, what we call the family of cycling. He's still very, I'd be surprised if he becomes big headed. I think he's very accessible. Although he's going to, you know, like you said, I mean, a Brit that wins a Grand Tour, he is going to have a lot of media attention. So, you know, we'll see. But he's really, I wish him well. I'm very happy for him, that's for sure.
You know, before we bid adieu to the Giro, Hoodie, I just have a quick question for you. What did you make of Team Sunweb's strategy in these last few decisive stages? You know, they had Wilco Kelderman as, on paper, the GC leader. But first on the Stelvio and then to Sestriere, it's like Jai Hindley is the better climber. They made the decision to keep Jai Hindley with Teo and Rowan Dennis while Wilco got dropped. Was it the right move? Like, what are you doing that, you know, should they have pulled Jai Hindley to help Wilco Kelderman out.
Yeah, that was an interesting quandary for that team because on paper, it seemed that Wilco perhaps had the best chance to win the overall just based on how he time trials. But as we saw it play out in Milan, you know, that would not have been in the best way for the team to play that car because his time trial, Wilco's time trial, wasn't that great. And so you can imagine that there were some discussions of that behind the scenes. You would hope that there was some honest, talking among the riders saying, you know, how well do you feel? Because that's one of the main points of being with the race radio is that the riders can tell how they feel during the heat of the moment, say, hey, you know, my legs aren't feeling great, you know, go for it. You know, I'm not sure if those conversations happened in real time as they were going up Sestriere and up the Stelvio. But it was it was one of the situations where, you know, do you sacrifice the chance for the stage win to help a guy who might not actually even get the jersey or win the race? So I think they made the smart call that the sure bet was keep your best climber up the road. And I mean, it was every man for himself at that point anyway, even having a guy like Hindley, Pace, Wilco, how much time could he have actually saved? You know, it's impossible to save it. But I think, you send your guy up the road, get the jersey, get the stage win, whatever happens on the Sunday, it's just the roll of the dice.
Yeah, when you look back at that, they got caught out there kind of because, you know, when I've never seen, and Wilco got dropped very early on the Stelvio. It was pretty amazing. He was able to pace himself and get the at the finish because he had about 2:45, right, going into the stage, and he lost all but about 12 seconds of that. And you know, there's no guarantee when you come off at 6K before the Stelvio, and you still got to get over the hardest part of the Stelvio down and then up the final climb, you're going to be able to maintain that. And at the same time, he wasn't able to follow anybody's wheels. He was all on his own. I certainly don't think that if they'd held Lindley back, it was going to help much. If you look at it, he was he lost about a minute. He was a minute and a half down. He couldn't have lost more than, you know, he needed to go into that last time trial, no less than 30 seconds down to have a, you know, clear shot at winning. He couldn't follow anybody's wheels. Plenty of groups came up to him and weren't going that much faster. And he couldn't even stay on the, I mean, he's just like the one speed wonder at the end of that climbing stage. And again, kudos that he was able to maintain it, but I don't think that having a guy pacing him was going to gain him a lot of time. On the same hand, if Lindley had gone on the attack, that was risky too, because he was going to have to be able to drop Gegenhardt by at least, you know, he needed to get at least 30 seconds, 30, 45 seconds. He needed 40, you know, at least 30 to 45 seconds. And going into that last TT, history tells us this, and there's no guarantee he was going to get that. So he could have gone, started taking pulls on over the Stelvio or on the final climb, buried Wilco and any chances for pink, not gotten the pink, not gotten the stage win, and then not been in a winning position for final victory in Milan. It was a hard call. And, you know, even though both these riders are young and untested at this level, Gegenhardt has a lot more experience and had a lot more, you know, track record. I was looking at their TTs, for example, and neither of them was a stellar TT rider, but Teo has had, you know, he's had some good top 10 performances in TTs in his career. So I was pretty convinced that he was gonna, you know, win pretty handily in Milan. But, you know, they're both in such unknown territories that it was hard for them to make these calculations. I think they probably did what they had to do, and they came out with a stage win. Came in with 2 days in pink. You know, I'm sure it's frustrating. At the end of the day, they got second, third. That's great, right? But I'm sure it's frustrating when you're so close to victory.
Scale of 1 to 5, how many glasses of grappa does this edition of the Giro get?
Well, I was on most of the race and really happy to be out there. So I would drink it up because I had a lot of fun covering the Giro, discovering it at this level. I've never done so much of the Giro.
I thought it was a pretty blocked race for a long time. In fact, I wrote some snarky column, I think, on the day of the Stelvio morning, just saying, you know, when's this Giro going to start? I felt like it was so back-ended, with so all the stuff, hard stuff, really packed into the end of the race that people were afraid to race. I mean, of course, we saw the big rider protest the next day after the Stelvio saying, come on, you know, 265 Ks in the rain and a world pandemic. They're like, oh, we're not going to race this. We've been racing like crazy every day. And the Giro is, everyone says the Giro is the hardest Grand Tour of the year in terms of just how long, you know, the stages are longer. I mean, the Giro is kind of old school. It keeps these, all the final stages in the last week were all over 200 K long. Whereas the Tour has been slowly morphing into almost a Vuelta style, a little bit shorter stages. You see in the Tour, even 140 kilometer stages now, packing the action. I mean, just the first week of the Vuelta, to me, was more exciting than the entire Giro. But having said that, the last two or three days of the Giro were very exciting to watch. So in the rating system, I'd give it a three, you know, three grappi this year. I mean,
yeah, I'm going with three. I share your sentiment. I was bummed to see all the big, you know, a number of GC stars bail on the race early. I didn't like seeing Garen Thomas go down and Simon Yates. And the fact that also, like, there was just a major COVID-19 outbreak. I mean, you know, the Tour de France had COVID with staffers going home and Christian Prudhomme, but this one had riders testing positive left and right. And, you know, the stuff about the hotels and the rider protest, there was sort of a cloud over this Giro. I'm happy to see Theo Gegenhardt win. But it was a grand tour. Guys, let's talk quickly about the Vuelta before we get out of here, because the Vuelta is heating up. Today was stage 7. We saw Michael Woods escape with a pretty thrilling stage win. He's off to Israel Startup Nation. Really psyched to see Mike Woods take that win. But the big dramatic stuff happened two stages ago. Rainy ascent of Formigal, which happened because France closes borders, so there's no Tourmalet stage. And the riders had to basically, oh, hey, no more Tourmalet, but we're going to Formigal in a driving rainstorm. And, you know, it seemed like Jumbo-Visma kind of laid an egg because Primoz Roglic was leading the race, and then he lost the jersey. Andy, what happened on that stage, and what do you make of Jumbo-Visma's strategic buffoonery that allowed Ineos to grab the dang red leader's jersey?
Yeah, it sounded like they were passing up some rain capes near the top of this penultimate climb. And remember that stage, the Formigal, that was the same route as the famous Frumigal stage of 2016 when Contador and Movistar all ganged up on Chris Froome and really knocked Froome out of contention that day under very different circumstances. That was kind of like one of these raids that caught out Sky early in that stage 5 years ago. And then it was just a drag race to the finish line, and Froome ended up losing, I think, two or three minutes and lost him a chance for the overall. And Quintana won. Very different than what happened on Sunday. They were passing up some rain capes. I was talking to Sepp Kuss on the rest day Monday, and he was saying that the mistake they made is they had their guy passing up the rain jackets a little bit too close to the top of that last climb. He was thinking that, you know, they should have had the Swannies, you know, another 500 or even 1,000 meters lower on that climb to kind of give them a chance to put that jacket on. Because he said as they were going up to the top of the – it was like a Katu summit. You know, Ineos, everyone's jostling for position because they wanted to be on the front of that kind of long, it was not really technical, but it was a long, wide open, fast descent down to the valley there at the base of the final climb. And Primoz couldn't get his rain jacket on. And so Sepp was explaining that he, Primoz, and Robert Hasink were just at the tail end of the peloton. And of course, it just split open. And, you know, once word got out that Ineos was already on the front, once word got out that Roglic was not there, Movistar came to the front. They just started drilling it. And Sepp said by the time they got to the bottom of the climb, there were a good 40 seconds, you know, between those two groups. And it was a full-on, you know, team time trial on that valley floor, kind of a long grinding valley, wind and rain and cold. And they had to set this huge effort. Sepp described it as a 10-minute race-winning effort for Roglic to get across to that group. And Sepp said it was too much for him. He blew up. He lost 10 minutes on the day. Roglic saved the day. George Bennett really helped tow him across. You know, he got in the front group. And then once the final two or three Ks there at the end, he got sharp and steep. you know, he just didn't have the legs to follow Carapaz. And it was a miserable day. It was, you know, in the mid-high 40s, rain, you know, some wind. So the guys were very cold at the end of a hard week. And Roglic, you know, had to spend those matches earlier in the stage and just didn't quite have enough octane there at the end of that stage. He lost 40 seconds. He's 30 seconds back, you know, laying an egg. Yeah, I lost the jersey, but they don't think the race is lost yet because they have this climbing time trial next Tuesday where everyone thinks that Roglic is going to get back a minute or more against all these climbers.
Got to learn how to put on them rain jackets. That's going to be my new VeloNews editor-in-chief decree for James and Andy and the rest of the staff. Got to put on those rain jackets. I mean, think of what we saw on the top of the dang Stelvio where poor Jai Hindley and Wilco Kelderman both were just mucking around with their rain capes trying to put it on for the descent. I thought Jai Hindley was going to roll off the road because his like arm kept getting stuck in it. And look, I'll be the first to admit, I have struggled to put on rain jackets while riding, have gotten off, you know, just like gotten off the bicycle to put it on. But what do we make then of this GC picture at La Vuelta? I mean, Carapaz is in the lead.
The Vuelta is one of the hardest races to read because there's about 16 different races inside the Vuelta. You know, the race for the different stages and the best climbers jersey and the different climbers. I mean, I was looking at, you know, Guillaume Martin, who he came in looking at the GC performance, top 10, top 5, got blown out on stage 2, and now all of a sudden is, you know, a stage hunter, and he's been in the break the last 3 days, and now he's got the polka dot jersey. So he, or you know, the best climber jersey. So he's going to be going in breaks every day, and there's breaks every day in the Vuelta that get away. That's the thing. It's sort of like so many Vueltas, like the majority of stages, the breakaway stays away, and there's really like, you know, at least two or three races within one. So it's very hard to read in my books. And when there's so many breakaways, there's also chances for guys who maybe lost a lot of time one day to all of a sudden get themselves back in the running. So I just think it's too early to tell.
Well, by the time listeners listen to this podcast, Wednesday's stage will either be going on or it will have concluded, which could shake up the GC picture even more because the race finishes up big old Catwund Alto de Moncavillo. And, you know, stay tuned to VeloNews.com because we'll have all sorts of news and information from that stage. Guys, we got a couple of great interviews to get to today. First, Andy Hood again caught up with Sepp Kuss. We heard from Sepp last week. Now we're checking in with Sepp again, and he talks all about Rain Cape Gate and bad situation for poor Jumbo Visma on stage 5. Then we hear from American Logan Owen. Logan is racing for Hugh Carthy. He's currently sitting second overall. This is Logan's second Vuelta. And he, of course, was part of that doomed EF team in 2019 that saw half its team crash out on the same stage. So Logan talks to us about some big differences between the 2019 and 2020 EF Pro Cycling team. So Andy Hood and James Stark, thank you so much for coming on to share your most passionate takes. And we will catch up with the both of you a week from today. All right, let's get on to Sepp Kuss and Logan Owen.
How did that turn out for you? Obviously, probably not like you had imagined.
Yeah, I think, you know, it wasn't a perfect day for us by any means. I mean, yeah, we started off great. It was a... it was a really strong breakaway that was away, but we had it everything under control, we knew that the second to last the descent before the final climb would be a bit nervous, but we also knew that we had fresh rain jackets waiting for us near the top, so. You know, it's always hectic 1K from the top. Everybody's moving up into position. And we had bags with rain jackets and it was a bit of a mess. And so Primoz, Robert and I were quite a ways behind trying to wrestle with the rain jackets. And it was a bit too calm of a moment for what the situation was at the very front, and it was breaking. And I tried to stay back with Primoz, And at that point, I didn't know there was so much urgency. I didn't know what was going on at the front of the race. But by the time we got to the bottom of the descent, I think the gap was probably 40 seconds or something. So we had to do everything we could to close it on the flat, had to bring the guys that were in the front group, we had to bring them back. And for myself, I just exploded trying to bridge that gap. And that was it for me. But luckily Primoz and George were back up in there and could limit the damage.
So when you guys passed up the rain jackets, was it windy? Was it raining? What was it like? Was this kind of one of those situations where your jacket's flapping and you can't put it on, and then suddenly Ineos and Movistar are pulling on the front?
Yeah, it was. I mean, at least for myself, it was a situation where I could have also gone without one, but I was thinking, we've got everything under control. It's better to, you know, not freeze on the descent. You know, cause it was also cold enough where if you get too cold during the stage, then your race is over as well. So it was, you have to take the risk, but at the same time, in retrospect, we should have put on fresh rain jackets long before that point, because we should have known that, of course, it's going to be a fight over the top of the climb, and once any other team sees Primoz near the back, they're going to drill it, of course. So definitely a mistake to be sleeping at that moment.
So it was you, Primoz,
and Robert.
Okay. And so then you guys went down, and then suddenly, I mean, how steep and technical was that descent? Was it pretty sketchy in the wet?
No, it really was. It was a pretty wide road, not really that technical, but I mean, when it's that wet, and if the pace in the front is super high, then there's going to be gaps. And yeah, at the time I didn't realize how far back in the peloton we were, but we were quite far back, which is not really acceptable to do when you have the race leader. We were really on the back foot.
So when you say when you guys got down towards the flats, you took some big pulls to try to bridge Primoz across, and then you said you blew up. And what happened there? You just kind of like couldn't quite catch that wheel, and then suddenly they were gone and you're by yourself?
Well, I mean, the other guys did a lot more than myself. I was just, trying to get up to them in the first place, and that was already a big effort. And then, it's so explosive. And then with the cold and everything, I just didn't have anything in the tank. So, it wasn't my best day either. Even if the circumstances were better, I think it would have been a day where I would have lost some time for sure. So, just really, really blew the engine on the bottom.
So then it looks like you settled into another group. And then at that point, it was just kind of, you kind of had the feeling that, you know, there was no point in trying to kill yourself to continue. I think what you lost, like 10 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, I tried for as long as I could to try and at least get up to the cars of that group, but Movistar, they were riding flat out in front. So it was, only a losing situation for myself. At least we had Primoz and George up there. So,
What was going through your mind at that moment, Sepp? Was it like, you know, did you feel like that you kind of blew an opportunity there? Or was it like, hey, at least we got Primoz in the place where he needs to be?
Oh, I mean, I wasn't too stressed, really. I mean, like we have Primoz still, and he's the strongest guy in the race, I think. And, that for us, that we want to win the race with Primoz. So, I think it was the only disappointment was that for myself losing time, we lost a bit of a tactical piece. If it's always better to have more guys on GC, because that also helps Primoz a lot. But it just wasn't meant to be. So you already have to move on. And, I think the same goal is still there, though, to help Primoz. So.
Oh, for sure. Well, was there any discussion on the team bus or kind of a breakdown after the stage before dinner last night? Or you guys talk about it this morning?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, you know, it was definitely not a good day. We were just, especially Primoz and myself, we were just too relaxed at a moment where it was a bit critical. So we shouldn't have been that far back. We should have just ditched the rain jackets and gone straight to the front. But yeah, also from the team side, maybe we should have organized something different with getting jackets a bit earlier.
Mm. Primoz did manage to pretty much, you know, save the day. Didn't save the jersey, but, you know, limited his losses 30 seconds back. I mean, when you look at the rest of the race, we were just, in fact, talking to Dan Martin right now, and he's saying that, you know, we need to get – the climbers need to get another minute or 2 minutes out of Primoz before that time trial next Tuesday. Is that kind of what you guys are thinking as well, that you're still kind of have the advantage even though you lost a little bit of time yesterday?
Yeah, I think even with the time lost, it's not huge. And I think under better circumstances – Primoz is right with those guys, or even better. I mean, if we look at it in the context, yesterday he had to do 5 to 10 minutes of more or less of race winning effort just to get up to that group. So,
wow.
Of course, he didn't have anything left when it came down to it. So yeah, I think in the mountains we can still be really confident that he can get some time back, and then of course in the time trial as well he can really do some damage there. So yeah, we'll see. I mean, it's a different situation now that we're not in the red jersey, so that also brings more opportunities. We can rest our guys a bit more and play it a bit differently.
Just final question: is there a sense that The rug might be pulled out from you guys at any day? I mean, is there a sense of, like, you know, we need to get the jersey now because the race might be canceled tomorrow?
Not too much. I mean, I think, you know, with something like that, that's so out of your control. From everything we've heard, there's no risk of that. I mean, aside from what regulations the government puts in place. But I mean, it's also strange to win a grand tour that only races for a week or a week and a half. So
all right, my guest today on the Velo News podcast is American Logan Owen. Logan is racing the Vuelta a España, which is going on in the end of October. There's rainstorms, there's crazy racing, there's all sorts of zaniness going on. Logan, thanks for joining us on the podcast. First of all, you talked about this before getting started. I mean, it's rest day, you don't really know where you are, you're somewhere in Spain, and how that is, like, that's so 2020. Like, what's it like racing right now at the end of October in Spain? What is that like for you?
It's for me, it's actually not too different because I've done a lot of cyclocross in the past, so I'm used to racing around this time of year. But I think for a lot of the other guys, it's pretty unknown territory, and I haven't raced cross in years, so it does feel really weird. Normally we're taking a break around this time and at home, kind of off the bike, just enjoying life a little bit. And now we're racing full gas in a grand tour and in like October, November. So yeah, it's weird. It's really weird. But just kind of rolling with the punches right now.
Yeah, because, I mean, in talking to a number of riders, you know, you had 4.5 months, quote unquote, off due to COVID. But it's not like everyone just stopped training or stopped riding their bikes. And so trying to keep the body fit and the brain motivated for this long and now racing full gas day in, day out. I mean, is it more of a challenge in your conversations with guys in the bunch? I mean, does it seem like it's more of a challenge for the body or more of a challenge for, like, the mind and the spirit at this point?
I think it was definitely tougher for the mind. I don't think it's the body as much. I mean, trying to stay motivated for 4 months, like, with no races, that was really, really difficult. And now that we're finally getting to race. It's all at once. And yeah, it's, I don't know. It was hard to stay motivated, I think, during that time, but at least for me, I'm excited to be back racing because we haven't really got to race much this year. And, but it is weird that it's this late. But the other guys that, yeah, I don't know. I think for them, it's around the same. Yep. I don't know.
Well, hey, we got a lot to get to about this wacky Vuelta a España. You know, we're recording this on Monday, the first rest day. And yesterday on Sunday, we saw you guys tackle this rainy, cold, miserable stage that finished up to Formigal. Originally, the stage was supposed to cross into France and finish on the Tourmalet. But right, you know, right before the stage happened, day before or so, the French authorities shut things down due to COVID. And so the Vuelta had to completely reroute the thing. Take me through what it's like being inside a team when all of a sudden, you know, a stage and a series of climbs you've been planning for a long time gets completely thrown out the window and you're delivered a completely new stage. Like, what is that like inside of the team when a big pivot like that happens?
Actually, I mean, I don't think it wasn't too much of a change. Like, we knew it was going to be a hard stage anyway, and it became a slightly less hard stage on profile. But I think in the end, it shook things up just as much as the Tourmalet stage would have in the past. We planned for one stage, and this stage was very similar. It wasn't too much of a shakeup, so it was, yeah, I mean, it wasn't. Yeah, it wasn't too crazy. I was excited, though. It was slightly easier, so I didn't want to start on a Cat 1 climb. I'm just going to say right now.
From a planning situation, though, is it like, hey, you know, you guys know these roads pretty well, like, just kind of go for it? Or do the DSs have to, like, redo their maps and have a new meeting and have a new, you know, like, series of, like, strategic elements to the stage? Or is it pretty much just like, you guys are pros and you know what to do?
Yeah, I mean, it didn't change the plan much. I think the same thing was going to happen whether it was the original stage or the stage that we ended up having yesterday. It was they were very similar stages, like I said, and one was just slightly easier, but not by much. And it I don't think it felt any easier because of the way we raced it. So yeah, I don't think it didn't really change much, to be honest. But had it been something like from a flat stage to a mountain stage, that would have really shook things up and been kind of crazy. Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously the other big storyline going on with this Vuelta is the fact that like all the other races is going on amid COVID-19. Spain is having, it sounds like, a COVID-19 resurgence. And it sounds like from talking to other riders, the race has been pretty good about, you know, keeping the bubbles intact and keeping you guys sequestered. You know, what's it like right now racing amid the pandemic? Like, what's the biggest differences you're noticing in this Vuelta compared to a normal Vuelta?
Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot of fans coming to the starts. There are still people coming, but the organization is asking them not to show up on any of the climbs, any of the starts, any of the finishes, which I think it's a really good thing because of the way everything's happened this year with COVID. But compared to a normal Vuelta, I've only done it once before, which was last year. There's no fans on the roads, or hardly any fans, I should say. And, we're wearing masks everywhere, sanitizers everywhere. Yeah, it's a weird vibe from the, like, racing during all this. It's hard to explain. It's just, we have a bigger thing to worry about in the world right now, and we're trying to do the best we can right now with bike race. So I don't know. We're just taking it the best we can. I don't know. It's definitely different.
In talking with Americans at the Giro, they talked about how, yeah, you know, like, there was, the fans were being pretty good and the organization was good at keeping fans away, but they were a little turned off by the hotel situation and felt like, hey, you know, we're staying in these hotels that are packed with, like, tourists and stuff like that. And I mean, what's your assessment of, just the bubble in general at the Vuelta? Are you feeling pretty safe and secure?
Yeah, I'd say for the most part, we've only had one hotel where I think it was a little bit iffy. The bubble getting kind of broken a little bit. But for the most part, every hotel and everywhere we've been, it's been pretty tight and packed. So I don't think there hasn't been a lot of options for outside people to kind of get in and ruin our little bubble that we have. No, I think it's been pretty good. I think they've done a really good job so far.
What's the chatter like inside the Peloton right now when you're rolling around and talking with guys you know on other teams and, you know, other English speakers or Americans? Is it people talking about the pandemic, about how weird it is to be racing this late in the season? Like, what's sort of the social chatter like inside the Peloton?
Well, currently we haven't been doing a lot of talking. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
The first week has not been talking speed. We've been racing full gas, but I think for the most part, I think it's just the fact that we're racing this late. It seems really weird to a lot of people. And I think some people are motivated, some people aren't. I'm motivated. I'm enjoying it. But I think there's some other guys in the Peloton that are kind of over it and just kind of want to end their season after a long year. So I think that's the biggest thing right now. Yeah, we haven't been doing a lot of talking.
Really? So it's been flat out then?
Yeah, there's been one day where it was slightly easier, but pretty much every day has been full gas racing.
So last year, you guys, you ride for EF Pro Cycling. You came into the race with, you know, pretty big ambitions and then like lost half your team on one stage when everybody crashed out. It was a huge bummer. Now this year, you have Hugh Carthy sitting in second place overall and looking really strong. How does that change the overall mood inside the team, you know, going from last year where it was real tough setback to this year where you have a guy who's looking really strong and way up there? How does it feel different given that situation?
Well, we've actually kind of had a little bit of a roller coaster with like Woods and Danny crashing on the stage one. I went down with Danny when he crashed, and he just landed really weird and he ended up hurting his ankle pretty bad. So he lost a bunch of time and then ended up having to drop out because of it. And so he was our main guy for the GC. We really wanted to see what he could do. And having lost him and then having Woods lose a bunch of time on the first day, I mean, he wasn't the big GC ambition. Mike wasn't at the time. He's more looking for stages, but he also with another card to play potentially on the GC, depending on how he was feeling, how he was riding. And to have Hugh kind of step up and fill that role it's pretty awesome to see. And so now we're we went from feeling like we lost kind of our main ambitions with the GC, not really lost them, but we felt like maybe we had less of a chance. So. But I mean, he's been killing it this week. He's riding so, so strong. Like, it's so impressive to see him do that. So hopefully we can help him all the way to the end, and maybe he can come away with a win.
How does that change the level of stress within the team, though?
I mean, from the beginning, I think Hugh planned on doing the GC, and we talked about it before the race. But he was always kind of he was just going to try and see how it went. He has no pressure on him. And I think we're still kind of taking it in that same scenario because he's just trying. This is the first time really trying to go for GC in a Grand Tour. So, I mean, we're not going to like put so much pressure on him because it's his first time doing it. Like, I don't think Wanda or Ken feel like they need to put pressure on him because it's his first time. So. We're just kind of rolling with punches and taking it day by day and just trying to help him as much as possible. And in the end, it's like we're going to do the talking.
Well, hey, man, thanks again. I'll let you get back to it. But, yeah. You know, good luck. Thanks, and man. I'll be in touch.